All right, April 29th, 2025. And what else is there to say? I did want to let you all know that I've updated the my well, I'll put all the recordings that we have of this class up on YouTube and on my podcast thing stream. And actually, that was a good opportunity for me to listen to a little bit of what I've been talking about. And I realized I haven't really been talking about recovery much. So I'm going to try to bring it back to that topic in one way or another today. A lot of times I just start thinking about meditation or, Dharma, which in my mind is always related in some way to recovery. But for those who aren't in my mind, it might not sound like that. So there we are. So it looks like maybe things have slowed down. I'll keep an eye out on the waiting room. Nice to see everybody. I'm just scrolling through to see everybody who's here. I did want to thank various people who have been supporting me in various ways. Jeff, that was very kind of you to come all the way to Benicia. Well, not all the way, but to come to Benicia just for the purpose of giving Donna, despite your physical limitations. You probably didn't miss much. I gave a talk, but that was and the Reverend Freakchild just also sent me a birthday present. Thank you. And also your girlfriend's blog. That's very interesting. So anyway, these are like the private messages we're getting here. Let us just start with some sitting and then get on with Dharma and recovery. Settling into your posture, coming into stillness. Just take a few moments to establish that. And you can close your eyes or just lower your gaze and bringing the attention inward, feeling your body to start. Even this simple instruction can be challenging at times. Get out of our head enough to feel our body. We're trying to, in a sense, embed the attention in the body, not just a cursory glance, but really feel yourself sitting. And feeling the breath in the body. However that appears for you. There's no right or wrong way to bring mindfulness to the breath. can be felt, the nostrils, the belly, the chest, it can be felt in the lower back. People report feeling the breath all over the body. And seeing if you can just let the attention rest on the breath. That rhythmic flow, sensations, breathing in, breathing out, movement, touch. Very simple. And when you notice the mind wandering, thoughts taking you away from the breath, acknowledge that and gently return. Takes time for any settling to happen in meditation, typically. But we need to bring a bit of patience to the process. Just staying with the simple effort to be with the breath and return to the breath. Letting go of judgments or grasping, trying to hold the breath, or push away thoughts. And just sensing, feeling. the patterns of thought, the habits and persistent thought patterns. These can be very informative, but not to spend time on analyzing or judging, just to notice what is it that keeps appearing? What is it that keeps pulling me away? And coming back to the breath. Noticing the changing experience of sitting. First, we may be restless and then start to relax and get drowsy. Noticing how the posture changes. If there are particular thoughts that are sticking. Having a sense of spaciousness, not trying to cling to the breath or push away thoughts, recognizing that the mind is vast, it can contain many things. Letting the breath be the foreground of experience and other sense impressions, thoughts, sounds, sensations move through that same space. then. Well, welcome again. I just wanted to mention that this Sunday morning, Pacific time, I'll be on the Buddhist Recovery Network Academy. And they always ask you to give a title for a talk. So the title of the talk is Who Is Myself? which is the title of a Iyakema book. So I'm going to go and look at that book and figure out what that means. I'll probably wind up talking about the five aggregates since that's been such a persistent theme for me lately. But yeah, I actually am planning to do a little bit of sitting for a few days, starting on Friday when my wife is going away, going for a swimming trek to the to Baja. So I'm gonna do a little self-retreat over the weekend, and so maybe by Sunday morning I'll be enlightened, and I'll be able to transmit right through Zoom all that magical energy that will fix you. So show up, you never know. So as I mentioned before, I was listening to the I was putting a bunch of my talks from the last month or so up on YouTube and on my podcast feed, and I noticed that they mostly were seemed to be mostly about meditation. Of course, I didn't listen to the whole talks, so I just listened to the beginnings, but and Dharma, but not a, it didn't seem like there was much focus on recovery, so I thought I would kind of try to bring it back to that topic today, a little bit more. There was this is, become a theme too, is, the New York Times science section that comes out on Tuesday morning. So I glance at it before I have breakfast and before I come down to teach. And there was something about how people figure out when they've had enough to eat. And it's like, really, I could not really understand it, but it's like a very primal quality that's like there's no like thinking involved in it, and people and it, like, of course, it's like a study using rats, but just it got me thinking about craving, and so I realized I have a little piece, so I've been working on something that may become a book. And it's called Let It Go, and it's starts by talking about letting go of behaviors. And winds up at the end of the book, it's like letting go of self. So it kind of goes through behaviors and then working with pain and then meditation and letting go through meditation and then. But one of the early sections is just called craving in the behavior section. So I thought I'd start by reading some of this, and then see where that leads me. So imagine what would happen if you never got hungry. If you had no craving for food, you probably wouldn't live very long. What if people had no sexual desire? How long would the species survive? It's clear that craving serves a vital purpose in our survival. With food, the basic cravings are more specific. Our bodies need energy, so we crave sugar in its many forms. Our bodies need fat. Our bodies need salt. At one time, humans spent most of their time trying to meet these needs. Rarely was there a surplus. Before the modern era, only the wealthy and powerful were overweight. Everyone else was lucky to get enough calories. We're not designed to have unlimited access to calories. We are designed to crave, not to be satisfied. That's kind of the key sentence, right? We are designed to crave, not to be satisfied. The nature of craving is to be hidden. It is meant to spur us to action, not reflection. It's compulsion is that we go out and get the thing that craving craves. Its underlying message is if you get it, you'll be satisfied, happy, content. And it is lying to us. There is no moment of completion or final satisfaction. Every meal is followed by another meal, every purchase followed by another purchase. Now I realize this next paragraph is kind of like something I wrote in one breath at a time, but what do you want after 20 years of writing the same book? Anyway, self-criticism put aside. I enjoy watching sports, and it's striking to me that at the very moment of success, during the championship celebration, the athlete often speaks of their desire to win again. They've just completed a grueling season of games, climbed to the top of their profession, and instead of resting on their laurels, they are projecting out to next year. It's never enough. That's what craving tells us. That's why we have to learn to let go. Letting go of craving starts with feeling craving in its many forms. We need to bring it out of hiding so that we can see its nature. How does it feel? In one form, not good. That's why we act on it. We might feel empty, hungry, unsatisfied, needy. Naturally, we want to get away from these feelings, and so we chase the thing that the craving says will take care of that discomfort. Another form of craving is trickier. It can feel uplifting, as if we are on the precipice of joy, of pleasure. Ajahnamurobe points to research that shows the greatest moment of pleasure is right before an action. The sweating mug of beer is placed in front of us. We pull our credit card out to make the purchase. Our lover pulls us close. The pleasure of that moment, though, isn't what we are actually enjoying. Rather, the sense that it is here, all obstructions are gone, the wait is over, we now are going to experience the object of our desire. One of the goals of mindfulness and the whole Buddhist path is to become okay with the feeling of craving. We learn to hold that energy without acting. We breathe and accept. The wisdom of the Four Noble Truths is that things will never be perfect, but that's okay. That in fact, we will find the most comfort, the most contentment, when we stop seeking after comfort and contentment. This is the inherent paradox to the Buddhist teaching. So that's, as long as I'm critiquing myself, I didn't think that was too bad. Kind of like the flow of it, but this question of craving is so interesting. Judd Brewer has that book, The Craving Mind, and it's really all based on the science of craving, right? Which, for me, as someone who got sober and Alcoholics Anonymous and likes to meditate, the science isn't so important to me, but it's interesting just to put together the corollaries between the experience and then the what the science says. The one of the exercises that I have in my workbook, the so-called Buddhism and the 12 Steps workbook, something I actually got from Larry Yang on a day-long retreat, probably 20 some years ago. And I've kind of adapted it a bit. I'm not sure exactly how he put it, but the way I put it now, and I use it in a lot of my retreats, and so many of you have actually worked with it, those of you who've been on retreats with me, is this question: what is the desire that my addiction was trying to satisfy? So obviously the implicit message is that your addiction, the specific addiction you had was not the whole of your desire. It was not even what you were really trying to satisfy, that there was something underneath there. And I was thinking about that this morning, while I was sitting and sort of reflecting on what I might talk about today. And I kind of have my own answer to that question: what is the desire that my addiction was trying to satisfy? But it can kind of it can morph a bit. And one of the things I think is, very different from this idea of craving as the cause of addiction, but rather that there's, and this is also kind of modern addiction thought, which is that there's a wound, that we're trying to heal in some way. And so that's the kind of trauma idea. I'm not trying to, find the singular, the unitary theory of addiction, but just to kind of, look from different angles and pull out different threads. And so that to me is that there is this sort of existential, maybe pain or just emotional pain or trauma, however you describe it, that we're trying to cope with. And we went out to dinner for my daughter's birthday, not my wife, my daughter. Since she was leaving on her birthday, we went to dinner and in this very nice restaurant in Berkeley. Which, by the way, it's really expensive to go out to nice restaurants. It's get like twice what it used to be. Like, I hate to say it, but inflation is a real thing. Anyway, I look around and it was a lot of older people because only older people can afford to go to these restaurants. But anyway, sorry for the commentary. And it's people having glasses of wine, for an alcoholic, I mean, first of all, I never liked wine, so I don't even get the whole thing. But I know some of you probably l loved wine, and that. But so for me, drinking was just, a way of providing the needed intoxicant into my body. It wasn't, oh, this really goes well with the fillet of sole that I'm having, this white wine, yes. This red is perfect with the lamb chop, No, like, forget it. Anyway. So it's hard, I think, for me, I'm sure for some of you too, to sort of look at that and like even understand what are they doing? Like the idea of like, oh, I'll get just a l slight buzz. I'll just get, and of course we see this in movies and TV all the time where people just have a glass of wine and they don't show any, exhibit any signs. And I'm like, why? So you're drinking for the flavor? Or anyway, I guess this is what makes an addict, is that the idea of like just a mild, slight buzz is like, all I'm going to want from that is more. I'm just going to want more. And so, is there I mean, coming back to this, like, is there a wound that I'm trying to, just wipe out? Maybe, that's certainly one quality here, or one aspect of this thing of getting intoxicated is just, the Buddha talks about the forms of craving, the sensual craving, the craving to be, and the craving to not be, or non-existence. And that third one is really very often part of addiction, right? I usually equate it with like heroin, where you're just kind of deadening yourself. But clearly, like just alcohol or any drug, any intoxicant, in as well as food and other behaviors, are trying to suppress, kill off the feelings that are painful. So even that question, what is the desire that my addiction was trying to satisfy? It's not necessarily a desire to get something or to even get intoxicated. So it can be an aversive desire, right? A negative desire, a desire to get rid of a feeling. And I think again, I sort of have to call upon movies and TV to think about how people use alcohol in at least semi-normal ways, that they drink at the end of a day of work when they want to get rid of the feeling of stress or that the challenges of their work day. And so this craving, I mean, it's I'm really just, as I do, just talking here and following one thought after another. So craving, we can say, has these two expressions, the grasping expression and the pushing away expression. And addictive craving operates in both these ways, and sometimes both at the same time, right? I want to get rid of this pain, whether it's trauma or just stress. And I want to get into this state, this euphoric state, right? This transcendent state, which is why then people also connect intoxication with spiritual longing. That was Christina Grof's thesis in her book, The Thirst for Wholeness. If you're not familiar with that, it's quite an interesting idea that. And it's not, again, not unfamiliar to alcoholics. It's in, I think it's implied in the Big Book, and this idea that intoxication has a spiritual aspect to it, the transcendent aspect, and that addiction is, or even just seeking intoxication, is a like a misguided, an unwholesome, shall we say, approach to spiritual, to answering a spiritual longing. And then you move into the plant medicine realm, which I just won't even get into it right now, but just to say that that's clearly like this, line between intoxication and spiritual journey. So, I don't know. Just, thinking about craving and thinking about, being an alcoholic. I mean, here's Monica going to Ireland, where. When you go out to dinner in Ireland, I mean, when you do anything in Ireland at night, you go to the pub because that's where life is, and it's beautiful. It's like the center of each village and each town, and the music and the social life. And so when we were there in 2015, almost every night we would go out to dinner in a pub, and I n noticed on the last night there, and then we were just by then we were just in a hotel by the airport in Dublin, but in this nice restaurant, and the Guinness just started to look normal. And it looked harmless, which is really dangerous for me. And it's really surprised me because, at that point I was, what, 30, 20 years, I don't know. How long ago was that? 10 years ago. So 30 years sober. And rarely do I have a craving to drink? And it wasn't that I had a craving, but what to drink, but I had a craving to be part of that community, and that was part of being part of that community. And it's very interesting just to see that and see the risk inherent in that. I've always, thought that if I ever moved to Ireland, I would have to really go to a lot of meetings. But again, we start to find all these subtle ways that craving operates, right? It's not straightforward, and our addiction and our addictive habits are, they're clever, and they show up in these, interesting ways. And I know many people, and probably many of you, have had relapses at some point, and when you look back at them, it's like, well, what was being, what led up to that? And it's not like a straight road, it's a lot of, you're probably driving on the left-hand side too, it's just a little like, oh, I've been having dinner in pubs every night, and now Guinness looks normal. Like, I think that's a classic way to have a relapse, because it's like, oh, it looked, as I said, normal and harmless. And on Sunday, when we were out to dinner, I sort of took a moment, because my daughter has had a glass of wine. She seems to be able to drink in a so-called normal fashion, and I kind of looked around and I thought about, how does that feel to have that first glass of wine, and I'll say, one time when I got a real opportunity to feel how alcohol felt was when I stopped drinking for like 6 months when I was in my 20s. I kept smoking pot. But I stopped drinking, and I remember the first time I had a beer at the end of that period. I was in a club in my hometown watching a band that I knew, and I just had a beer. I hadn't stopped drinking because I thought I was an alcoholic. It was other, like, I thought, like, it's more healthy or something. I had read some book. But anyway, I had a beer, and the way it felt was bad, actually. It felt like there was poison in my body. And I've told this story before. I don't tell it a lot, but my automatic reaction was to have another beer, because I knew that I needed to get over that first feeling of being poisoned and get to the point where I felt high, and then I wouldn't feel it as poison. I mean, I did, it wasn't there wasn't a lot of conscious thought in that decision. It was just like, oh, I need an, like, what's going to make me feel better? What would have made me feel better was to put the beer down, go home, make a cup of chamomile tea, go to bed. But no, like, and so that was a really good lesson to remember now, and to remember once I got sober, that the way it feels when alcohol first gets in your body, if you actually are paying attention to it, is it feels bad. At least it did to me, it does to me. And maybe that's, one of the reasons I'm an alcoholic. I don't know. Anyway, I see Jeff has had his hand up for a while. We got the link to the Buddhist Recovery Network event in there. Good. And thank you for the thirst for wholeness. Yeah, that's an interesting one. So, Jeff, did you want to say something, or did you just trip over your computer and the
No,
hand
I
went
do.
up?
I don't have my computer on the floor, Tim.
How are you feeling?
Just now, okay.
Okay, good. Keep moving.
That's the idea.
Yeah.
So you asked a question in your talk, which is which caused a cascade of thoughts and the desire to share them. What I it came to my attention as I did a quick review that everything that I've ever gotten addicted to, and there's more than one.
Shocking.
It began with a desire for connection with my fellows. That, that the pub, I mean, the reason the pubs are so fun is because everybody knows your name, even if they don't, even if they can't pronounce it at that moment. When I go to Ireland, I go to the same four or five pubs every time because I know the guys that hang there for quite some time. But I make it a stern rule. When they start to go, I'm out the door. You don't want to be in a fight in a foreign country. But every addiction that I've gotten started out with a desire to be next to somebody, to be in a communal situation. And I think that may be the fear of lone, not the fear of, but the desire to not have, not be lonely, may be someplace underneath all of this stuff. The great lie, though, the big lie is that if I drink with these guys, I won't be lonely anymore. And then eventually you're in a dark room by yourself. It's inevitable. So just exactly what you think is going to fix this particular problem, the longing to belong, I see, and just put up the longing to belong. Just what you think is the solution to this problem is, in fact, the greatest cause. That's all I've got today, Ben.
That's great. Thanks, Jeff. And that's very much in alignment with where I arrived at with that question, which I liked, I did, and I was, I guess, first shown to do as a kind of continuing, repeating question, like kind of to dig underneath. And as you say, when you get down to the root of it, there's some kind of a longing for connection. And I just put that in the simple terms, the longing to feel loved, to feel, not to be loved, because people can love you and it doesn't mean any, it doesn't do anything for you, but to feel loved, to feel a connection. So I think that's for me, that's an important distinction. Like, I can say I'm connected with people, but do I actually feel that connection? And if I don't feel the connection, it can be like you're at your family reunion and these are all really important people to you, but you're just not feeling anyway hard. And that the challenge is that's why it comes back on ourselves. That there isn't some solution of like being loved or belonging, that everybody in the pub knows you and likes you. It's like that you can still feel lonely, even in that boisterous room with the music playing. It can feel like you're in the dark room alone. Anyway, just if people aren't depressed enough. Cheryl, hi. Whoop.
I'm still
There you go.
go. I love the topic today, and I want to thank you and the previous share was awesome. But as you were talking, you mentioned that intoxication can have a spiritual aspect, and I'm thinking of the previous share as well. It's really all about connection. We're craving connection, be it with individuals or spiritually, and as I thought about it, I thought about how many of the world's great religious traditions do involve substances of some sort in their ritual practices. I do know, for instance, in Catholicism, they use, wine at their mass ceremonies, and I understand there's a great deal of alcoholism amongst priests. I don't know how relevant that is. And then I thought about, in the Muslim tradition, the whirling dervishes. I've always thought I'd want to try that, where I could just spin out, put on a costume and spin till I became euphoric. And then I started to think about just simple things, like it's springtime. If I plant a garden, I'm going to plant a really good garden. It's like excess. It's like craving to the point of excess that I think is part of an alcoholic, my alcoholic nature. If I go to a yoga class, I'm going to hold that form and that pose the best. I'm going to do it really good, and it's the idea of excess. I don't know what that's all about. Those are some of the thoughts that just kind of popped into my head. Maybe you have some commentary on it, but yeah, even if it's not substance, even if it's some type of behavior as well, that it's that longing, which is not a bad thing. I've always thought that alcoholics are seekers. That's a plus that we have going for us. We're seeking something that could be very positive. Somehow we misapply some things
No,
in trying to get there. Yeah.
I mean, certainly like altered states are seem to be a persistent thing that humans crave, and meditation itself can create altered states, and I think a lot of people come to meditation seeking out altered states. It's one of the reasons people get frustrated or disappointed with meditations, that they don't get to an altered state. So yeah, I mean, that's just again something we have to manage. Like that's what it seems like. One of the big problems with addicts, to state the obvious, is that we don't have limits, and that's kind of the epitome of addiction, is just that we don't have boundaries and limits. A glass of wine just doesn't make any sense to us. The we got to have the whole bottle, and we need to have an extra bottle in case the first bottle isn't enough. And so the same then is true of whirling dervishes. You're going to be the whirling dervish that winds up throwing up because you were getting no one to stop. And people get very attached to meditation and striving for that. People who were like, quote, addicted to meditation retreats, they kind of like can't wait to get to the next retreat so that they can get into that state, Yeah, so I don't have the answer for that. But John, go ahead.
Thanks, Kevin. Yeah, it's a great topic, and I had a recent experience that was intoxicating, and it was wholesome experience. It was great, and I got a lot of positive feedback, and I found myself after like going, oh yeah, I kept thinking about it. I kept running it through my head about how wonderful this was. And it was amazingly similar to drinking. And I was curious because you're in a position, you've been recovering for, 40 some odd years, and you've been studying Buddhism for longer. How do you respond to sort of to adoration? Essentially, it was what it was. Exactly. You put yourself in front of people, and you write books, and people adore you, Kevin. That's gotta have, I'm among those, So I'm curious how you, as a practicing Buddhist and a recovering alcoholic, that stuff is much more powerful, frankly, than a bottle of beer.
It doesn't, I mean, it doesn't do what it sounds like you think it might do. And my way of sort of thinking about this connects with having been a musician and a performer and how that felt. And the way that felt was a constant craving for, yeah, but whether not adoration, but yeah, I mean, for my, I wanted people to, love love me as a musician and a performer. But I can tell you that the only times when I've had an intoxicating an experience related to any kind of like role, like public role, was when performing, particularly performing my own music, which I have only not done many times. Most of the time I've been playing other people's music or covers. And the few times, there have been a few times, and actually there was a time in the beginning of 2020 when I did it one show, and where I felt really like uplifted, well performing, like in this just state of joy that is just overwhelming. But it wasn't, there were only about 12 people there. And nobody was going crazy or, or trying to rip off my clothes. It wasn't about being adored. It was the experience of performing this music that feels so personal. But I mean, I'm very grateful that being a Dharma teacher and Dharma writer doesn't bring me that kind of thrill. It brings me a lot of satisfaction. And I really attribute that to the Dharma, that if you, and I think, and I'll say that I think that my motivation is pretty clean, is clean, and because of that, I'm guided by the Dharma. When I'm teaching, I'm really trying to be this teaching and live this teaching, and that at the heart of that is that, self and ego are not things to cultivate. That satisfying the ego craving is not freeing. And so, since I try to really believe that when I'm teaching it, I'm not just spouting something, it just doesn't hook me in that way. And I don't take it personally. Now, when I play my own songs, I take it incredibly personally. It's like, it feels like my songs are my identity, are me, are expressions of my identity, and so it's like how that goes over, like, is really critical to my ego. I don't feel like when I'm teaching Dharma that that's me, that, because I didn't make it up. So yeah, I'm just very, I consider myself fortunate, because I think that some people probably do get intoxicated by that and then need to keep, I don't know, hopefully that's, inherent to Dharma teachers. And we know that there have been some who have abused their role. So those are the ones who I would suspect, yes, we're taking too much ego gratification from it. Long answer. For a final question, we'll give it to Monica, who will is abandoning us and abandoning me because she doesn't really love me. But oh wait, I'm sorry. That might have not been wholesome. No, because Monica, and just everybody knows this, but just to remind you that she's shows up here and takes care of recording these classes, and she's the reason. If it weren't for her, we probably wouldn't have all these recordings, because I'd forget, or I wouldn't bother, I couldn't figure it out. But so thank you, Monica. And by the way, this class will be at about 7 o'clock in the evening when you're in Ireland. So, just a thought.
Okay.
But you'll be at the pub, but just don't drink, okay?
Oh, I don't. I again, you know that you I was just gonna tell you what you said just before really helped me. It was like a aha moment, and
Which was
but
that? Which thing that I said?
oh, just that you now feel the change between the way it used to be when you, because I used to be in bands, and I'm still to this day terrified of really propagating my music and my songs and stuff, because I would get so high on the adoration, you know, and also my photography. It took me a longish time to come back to the photography, and then when I did, it was for. I've been able to be of service more, and that has been this, you know, be through studying here, and that I can tell that when people want to praise me, I feel uncomfortable. Then I know that I'm doing the work. Yeah, I'm like, and so I understand. Thank you for your kind words, and if I can, I will try to be here just to be here.
No,
But
no. You should enjoy your vacation, please. Don't.
I'm gonna try, you know, I'm going to it's kind of an odyssey, you know. So it's, but everyone help, please help Kelvin. You know, please. No. It's a, well, I'm gone. But it's a it's love, it's service. I feel so grateful every time I come here that I get to do this. I feel very, very grateful. I didn't have a question. I was thinking about what you said about you're going to be there, and I think that's the fallacy of craving. That once we have some time under our belt, that we never crave again. You know, and that, you know, and when I crave, sometimes I feel guilty, like, oh gosh, yeah. And so just that self-love and that self-compassion. So that we have to and do the next right thing if you think you're in trouble, you know, because I don't know if I, you know what, a little bit of fear. I don't think I can, I don't know if I can get back here. Because I've already relapsed once a long time ago, but I just, yeah.
I have that. I think that's a wholesome fear. You know, that'd be like hiri and otapa, right? Shame and moral dread. It's like, oh, you know. There's no guarantees. I can't help but like think about this question now, coming back to this like ego. I don't want to pretend that I'm not impacted by people's appreciation for me, and that I'm like, oh yeah, it's fine, it's letting. No, it's very meaningful and touches me, and I care. Like, I'll tell you where my ego gets involved, like how many people came to my class, you know? That's where my ego comes in. Hey, there were like 50 people today, like, you know, so I don't mean to, you know, act as if I'm some transcendent Buddhist who has no attachments anymore. But I will say, like, I know we've run out, people are dropping away, and it's well past the time, but this I was just thinking about the difference between when you've been performing and getting a lot of love on stage, and then you go home and you're alone, the way that feels, versus for me, like when I teach and I go home, or you know, it's very different. Like I feel fulfilled and rich after teaching, you know. And often kind of relaxed. It's nice after performing and getting a lot of attention and love. And I know there's more than one performer here. You know, Steve used to play drums, and you know, when you're alone, it's like, oh, like there's an empty feeling to me. Like, oh, like because once again, it triggers that craving. Like I need, I got that. I got that. I got the drug. Let's just say I got the drug. I need more of the drug. This isn't right. You shouldn't stop giving me the drug now. I need the drug to be constant, which is why performers, I think, a lot of times wind up drinking excessively and becoming sexually addicted and because after the performance you need more, and those are the substitutes for it. It's really a painful cycle. I mean, I really feel sorry for people who were like rock stars for a minute, and then the rest of your life you're like can't and you see it's like the behind the me they're tr still trying to get it back, like you had that hit in 1982. It's like one more time and you're like you're 75, like nobody cares, like no, it's oh God, sad. Anyway, on that lovely note, I'm just gonna keep talking to myself and I'll
Dude,
be
I've
here
got
at home.
goodness in your ears, Rick.
Actually, I've been thinking about trying to work out a Jeff Beck song, so I think that'll be my next thing to do today. All right, everybody. Thanks for showing up and being part of this journey. And I'll be back next Tuesday, and maybe I'll see you then or with the Re Buddhist Recovery Network on Sunday morning.
Sounds good.
Thanks.
Bye,
Take
Kevin.
care, everybody.
Thanks, Kevin.
Thanks,
Hey,
Kevin.
Mike.
Hey, multiple mics. Bye.
Indeed. Take care.